Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, a former CIA analyst argues that the Central Intelligence Agency is badly in need of reform following a series of intelligence failures. And he says the politicization of the agency in the run-up to the war in Iraq is also a factor in terms of need for reform. Melvin Goodman says that among those notable failures, the inability to predict the fall of the Soviet Union, the absence of strategic intelligence on the 9/11 attacks, and what he calls the falsification of intelligence that permitted the Bush administration to go to war in Iraq. We'll find out more about the circumstances that led to significant intelligence failures and hear recommendations for a thoroughgoing reform. Mel Goodman is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. He was senior Soviet analyst at the CIA from 1966 to 1986, and he was intelligence advisor to the SALT delegation in 1971 and 72. And my guest's new book is Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Welcome to Open Line, Mel Goodman. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Fred. It's good to be with you.
And we're at 614-292-8513. Mel, what should Americans expect from their CIA, their Central Intelligence Agency? What should they be doing for us?
Well, the CIA was created by Harry Truman in 1947 to have an agency that would provide objective and balanced intelligence information to policymakers and decision makers. And this was the requirement that was recognized in the wake of the Pearl Harbor attacks when the intelligence was available in Washington. We had broken the Japanese military code. We knew that the Japanese had given instructions to break relations with the United States. We knew the Japanese had told their embassy to destroy all sensitive materials in Washington, and we couldn't find the Japanese fleet. So we had all the indicators of war, and this information was never distributed to the proper people. So essentially, a central intelligence agency, and the centrality I think is important here, is designed to make sure intelligence is collected in a way that is supportive of policy or gives policymakers what they need to know, but more importantly, that it gets to the right people so people have this very sensitive information. And this is where the CIA has failed us miserably in the last 20 years.
For example?
Well, I think the examples I would use, and you cite them in the introduction, would be the Soviet Union 9/11 in the Iraq War. In all cases, the intelligence collection was there to do the job right. Now, 9/11 was what I call a classic intelligence failure. That is, if your assumptions are wrong, then no matter how good the information is, if you don't change your assumptions, the facts will never deter you from sticking with your preconceived notions. In 9/11, we thought that al-Qaeda wouldn't attack here, that they would attack overseas, and the FBI similarly told the White House they don't have the network to attack here, so they'll attack overseas. But the collection was good. We knew what they were doing. We traced them back to 1993, the World Trade Center attack in 93. We knew about the Bohinca plot, which called for weaponizing commercial aircraft and flying them into prominent buildings. That operation was actually tried in France in the winter of 1994-1995, but it was broken up by French intelligence.
Was that against the Eiffel Tower?
That was designed to go against the Eiffel Tower, but the plane never got out of southern France, I think Marseille. It had to stop for refueling, and that's when French intelligence moved very adroitly and professionally and broke up the operation. And there were indicators along the way, including two key members of al-Qaeda, al-Hamzi and al-Madar, who were in California living under their true names and were the paymasters for the 9/11 operation. But the CIA never made sure these names were watchlisted so that the FBI could move in a clever fashion. And of course, the FBI had its own failures in ignoring the warnings from people such as Colleen Rowley in Minneapolis with regard to Massawi, or a very smart FBI field operative in Arizona who wanted the FBI to monitor all of the training centers for commercial aircraft because he was suspicious of all of the Middle Eastern men who were coming to Arizona to get flight training, even though they had no background on large commercial aircraft. So what's so sad about this is there was so much evidence that was collected, but it was not put to good use. But that's because people just made the wrong judgments. In the case of the Soviet Union in the 1980s...
May I ask you, Mel, about 9/11? So we knew about, obviously, the 1993 attempt to topple one World Trade Tower into another. And the CIA knew that there were al-Qaeda connections there?
Yeah, that was known from the very beginning. In fact, we had documents before the World Trade Center attack that were never translated by the FBI that would have provided the linkage between al-Qaeda and the World Trade Center attack. And when you look at the planning, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the brains behind the 9/11 operation, including the World Trade Center in 1993, his nephew was Ramzi Youssef, who was the one who came up with the Bohinca plot, which was broken up by the Philippines after there was an apartment fire where Ramzi Youssef was living. And the Philippines, of course, through liaison channels, passed this information to the CIA. So when you go back and look at it, it becomes even more mind-boggling. And then you realize what a bad job the 9/11 Commission did in really exploring the depth of these failures.
So if we knew that the 1993 attempt threw a bomb to topple one trade tower into the other and collapse them was al-Qaeda related, and we knew about this weaponization of airplanes with the attempt to, you know, on the Eiffel Tower projected, you mean there isn't a creative intelligence team at the CIA at the time that would sit down and use imagination and say, we've got an attempt to topple the trade centers. We know that airplanes can be weaponized. There could be some conclusions from this.
Well, I like the word imagination because it was a real failure of imagination, but also it was a real failure of methodology because at least what they should have done is set up a catalog or a file for weaponizing of commercial aircraft. This is what you do in warnings intelligence analysis. This is certainly, from my 20 years of experience as an intelligence analyst, what I would have done. But also, what I always worried about as an intelligence analyst, and I saw it in the 1980s failure with regard to the Soviet Union, when you let assumptions drive your facts, that's when you're often led down the wrong road. And in the case of the Soviet Union and the 9/11 case, certainly the assumptions began to drive the facts. So there must be a rigorous application of some methodology in which analysts are asked over and over again, what is the facts of the situation and what are the assumptions of this situation? Mm-hmm. And to make sure they're separate and the assumptions do not become more important than the facts. And of course, the other failure within the CIA particularly, and this is even worse now under their military leadership, is they don't protect their contrarian thinker. Usually some of the best intelligence information comes from someone who is challenging the conventional wisdom, who is that dissident or that contrarian. And I find in our society we don't really respect contrarians anymore. There's such an application of conventional thinking that we don't want to disturb unanimity, and the process of groupthink has really taken over. And there were contrarians, and I consider myself one of them, on the Soviet Union in the 1980s that warned, no, the Soviet Union wasn't this 10-foot-tall Russian bear who was threatening the United States. Actually, the Russian bear was getting very weak and was capitulating to the United States. And there were three or four contrarians, and we were all forced out of our positions by people like William Casey and his deputy Robert Gates, who is now the Secretary of Defense. And I still worry that contrarians are not being protected within the organization.
You would think that in any healthy organization there would be a culture that would encourage contrarian thinking and take it into consideration and debate it and discuss it.
Exactly. That's what the Israelis learned in the October War failure, which was their Pearl Harbor, really. This is the war that took place in 1973, which was a massive intelligence failure, particularly when you look at the losses of the Israelis in the first weeks of the war and the small size of their population. And again, there were contrarians. So what the Israelis did is they established basically a cadre committed to devil's advocacy, someone thinking the unthinkable, making sure imagination was implied to these scenarios, taking on the conventional wisdom, not in order to say that the sky was falling at every turn of events, but to make sure that all various scenarios had been explored and all various interpretations had been tried in terms of explaining events that we really don't understand. And this is even more important now than it was during the Cold War. The Cold War, we knew we were up against. We had good intelligence collection. The Soviet Union never introduced a weapon system that we didn't have advanced intelligence on, which I think says a lot for the CIA. But when you look at today's world of ethnic violence and ethnic tension and insurgency and religious groups we don't really understand, and the kind of small cells of terrorist activity, particularly nihilist terrorists, there's so much that we just do not know.
With regard to the Soviet Union, what were the wrong assumptions that led to a failure to predict that breakup?
I think the wrong assumptions included the fact that the Soviet Union was an aggressive power, which it wasn't, that the Soviet Union was going to challenge us militarily, which it never did, that the Soviet Union, and this was true from the late 1940s to the late 1960s, that the Soviet Union and China had formed an alliance and were bent on controlling the world of international communism. And this was the thinking, the wrong kind of strategic thinking, that got the Kennedy administration and then the Johnson administration involved in Vietnam, which, of course, was a foreign policy debacle, the worst of its kind until George Bush came along and gave us the Iraq War, which had its own false assumptions. So it was this thinking about the Soviet Union, not understanding the conservative nature of the Soviet Union and how risk-averse Russians really are, that led us to think that the Soviets were challenging us at every turn and every third world point, where we looked at these third world situations as zero-sum games and that we had to get involved in order to prevent a Soviet victory. This led to a lot of serious problems for the United States in the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, and certainly in Southeast Asia when you look at Vietnam in this context.
Did, as senior Soviet analyst at the CIA, Mel, did you understand the flaws in these assumptions, and did you try to tell people?
Well, that was sort of my modus operandi throughout the I joined there in the middle 60s, leaving Indiana University, the Russian Institute, to come to the CIA, and I was there through the 70s and the early 80s. And it really wasn't a problem to have a political director nominated for the Central Intelligence Agency. And William Casey was a very political director. He was involved in Reagan's campaign staff. He was given credit for turning the campaign around. He had a very strong ideological view of the Soviet Union, and he was serving a president who wanted to double defense spending in peacetime. What Ronald Reagan did was to send this country on a wave of peacetime defense spending that we had never seen in this country before. It was clearly unprecedented, and he needed the intelligence to go to the Congress to do that, in the same way that Bush needed intelligence to go to the Congress to get a war resolution with Iraq. So Casey's job was to make sure the CIA said all the correct things to support Reagan's notions about the Soviet threat. And that's what Casey did as director, and that's what Bob Gates did as deputy director for intelligence in the early 80s, and then deputy director of the CIA itself in the mid-80s. And when several of us called attention to this, and there were three key individuals, I was one of them working on Soviet foreign policy. Another was Douglas Gartoff, who was working on Soviet-American relations and was arguing correctly that the Soviets wanted to sign arms control agreements with the United States. And then there was an economic analyst by the name of James Norrin, who knew how weak the Soviet economy really was, which was far different from what the Reagan administration was saying to the Congress. We were forced out of our positions by Robert Gates in order for them to stay with a very politicized intelligence line that the Soviets were challenging us all over the world. And this led to all sorts of problems in the 1980s and the great delays in arms control. That was such an important part of Soviet-American relations throughout the 1970s, going back to the SALT and ABM agreements in 1972.
My guest, Melvin Goodman, is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. He was senior Soviet analyst at the CIA from 1966 to 1986, and he was intelligence advisor to the SALT delegation 1971-72. Mel Goodman's new book is Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email a comment or question to openline at WOSU.org. Well, Matt, what we don't want, obviously, is a CIA that's providing information driven by ideology or driven by political needs. But I guess in terms of the Soviet Union, we got one. And you say that still may be true. You write, the CIA no longer knows how to provide truth to power and lacks the courage to do so.
My experience in researching this book and talking to a lot of former colleagues, after all, I was at the CIA actually for 24 years from 66 to 1990, so I have good friends in the building, and I have a clear idea of what goes on there. And one of the real problems in terms of how the CIA does its business is this urge to be relevant to policymakers. And I've always found that this urge to be relevant gets you too close to the policy world. and that your ideas become really part and parcel of the policy community's ideas. So you collect intelligence that you think policymakers will find useful, and you analyze intelligence in a way that's appealing to policymakers. And you're hesitant to tell truth to power. I mean, often you have to introduce messages that are not convenient or not appreciated by policymakers, that challenge their policies on the Middle East or the Persian Gulf. And I worry that the CIA is not willing to do this in terms of telling truth to power. And again, now that you have general officers, retired generals, or in many cases active duty generals who are running all of these intelligence agencies, you have really people who not only come out of the policy process, but they come out of the Pentagon military policy, which always needs to be challenged, which is something Truman knew and President Eisenhower certainly knew, that you have a situation where the CIA is providing worst-case analysis to policymakers. And worst-case analysis really will lead the United States down a lot of roads leading to cul-de-sacs that are not going to be helpful to American national security. And this is my major concern.
So I guess you would, in a sense, I imagine, as a CIA, want to provide information that was useful to policymakers. Wouldn't that, in a sense, be kind of a definition of your job? But you're saying there's also then a tendency to provide information that conforms with the ideology of the policymakers or the assumptions of the policymakers?
Exactly. But usefulness goes in two directions. Usefulness goes in one direction in terms of telling policymakers what challenges are out there for American policy. But there's also a kind of intelligence that gives the policymaker the notion that maybe there are opportunities in certain areas. And certainly when you look at North Korea, for example, you know, it was clear to people who were collecting intelligence that North Korea wanted to negotiate with the United States. And this nuclear freeze that was finally negotiated at the end of last year is a pact that could have been negotiated 3 or 4 years ago. But again, the intelligence community was hesitant to tell the policymaker because there was such a bias against North Korea out of a foreign policy operation controlled by George Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and initially Condoleezza Rice that were opposed to any kind of dealings with North Korea. They didn't want to hear any intelligence that suggested North Korea was looking for openings with the United States. And this was certainly true in the 1980s when we had very good intelligence of how desperately the Soviet Union wanted to conduct arms control negotiations with the United States. And beginning in 1985 and 1986, when Gorbachev came into power, how the Soviet Union wanted to withdraw from Afghanistan. One of the first speeches that Gorbachev gave, and it was a secret speech, and we got the intelligence on this speech, was the reference to Afghanistan as a bleeding wound. And this was something that they were going to have to heal and repair very quickly if the Soviet Union was ever going to play a major international role in all sorts of political and military negotiations. But the administration didn't want to hear these messages, and Bill Casey and Bob Gates certainly didn't want to deliver these messages. And what he used to say to us in lecturing to us, let's not go around sticking our fingers in the eyes of policymakers. Well, granted, analysts should use their language carefully, but in part we're there to stick our fingers in their eyes. If we can alert them to the fact, for example, in 1983, when the Reagan administration put Marines in Lebanon, there were warnings from the intelligence community about how difficult that environment would be for the United States military to try to pull Israeli coals out of the fire in Lebanon. All of these intelligence messages were ignored, and as we know, the Marines were attacked. There were over 200 Marines killed, and within 48 hours, Ronald Reagan pulled these Marines out of Beirut. Well, that's the kind of disaster that could have been avoided. Vietnam could have been avoided if people had read the intelligence that the CIA was writing in the early 1960s about Vietnam as a civil war and had nothing to do with any kind of Sino-Soviet alliance. In fact, we warned the White House in the 1960s that there was a Sino-Soviet dispute, but people were not willing to take that on. And frankly, it wasn't until the Nixon administration, when Nixon and Kissinger looked at the CIA intelligence that talked about a Sino-Soviet dispute before anyone else in the academic community, or the government community for that matter, was alert to this new trend. So intelligence can play an important role, but if policymakers are not going to pay any attention to it, or CIA analysts are going to engage in self-censorship and not deliver certain messages because they're intimidated by a Dick Cheney or intimidated by a Donald Rumsfeld, then the system will not work. And so the very purpose for creating the CIA and the National Security Act of 1947 will have served no useful purpose whatsoever.
So, Mel, then, in the 1960s, prior to the Vietnam War, then you're suggesting there was a culture at the CIA that would say, we're going to tell truth to power. We are going to present this evidence at that time?
Well, actually, we prided ourselves on that. That was sort of our own little hubris. And maybe we overdid it at times, and maybe we did gratuitously stick our fingers in the eyes of policymakers. But frankly, we thought it was our obligation to tell it the way we saw it. And there was, as I say, a certain pride with that intelligence fraternity that took on issues in that way. And we certainly were not intimidated by policymakers. Now, we never had to deal with a Dick Cheney, a vice president who came out to the CIA, I'm told, 10 to 12 times to have an impact on the intelligence. I still think we would have stood up to even a vice president in that case. But if you have a director of the CIA who caves in, the way George Tenet told the president, oh, it'll be a slam dunk to give you the intelligence you need, Mr. President, to go to war against Iraq, then, of course, the situation becomes very difficult. But we did pride ourselves on giving the intelligence with the bark on, no matter how rough it was for policymakers to take on this particular message. We tried to tell them what we believe the intelligence was saying. Now, of course, at all times, you must tell them how good our collection is, how confident we are of our analysis. We have to separate our assumptions from our facts. And if you start losing control of this kind of methodology, which the intelligence community now has done, there's going to be a problem in the kind of intelligence you produce, and I think your credibility will suffer. But your credibility will never suffer more than it did during the run-up to the Iraq War, when the CIA virtually politicized all of the intelligence. When you look at the Colin Powell speech at the United Nations in February of 2003, which made the case to go to war, a speech that was written at the CIA by the leading officials of the CIA, and it contained 28 allegations, and every one of those allegations was false.
Hmm.
Well, when that happens, then it's time to start over. And basically what my book argues is the need to start over at the CIA.
So every one of the 28 allegations that Secretary of State Colin Powell made before the United Nations, in fact, I remember a couple of columnists saying, gee, the speech really convinced us that Iraq has WMD possibilities and is a real threat. All of them proved to be untrue.
Every one of the allegations was false. And as you say, the op-ed writers, and my favorite was Mary McGrory, who
yes.
was probably only the only liberal on the op-ed pages of the Washington Post. Her column was entitled, I'm Persuaded.
Yes, I remember that.
And it went on and on about what an effective presentation. And I submitted an op-ed to the Washington Post that challenged that thesis. And, of course, it wasn't accepted, so I had it run in the Baltimore Sun. But again, that's an interesting point because it was hard for contrarians to get their views to the journalists, particularly to the print media. There were only two journalists who really stood out in the run-up to war, and actually they've won some serious awards. I don't think they're widely known to the national community, but Jonathan Landy and Warren Strobel of the Scripps Howard Change were willing to talk to contrarians and take what they said and at least balance it with what the administration was saying. The New York Times wasn't doing this. Judith Miller wasn't doing this. Michael Gordon wasn't doing this. The Washington Post wasn't doing this. So I would have to, in terms of culpability and responsibility, the media have some role to play in whether they're going to take advantage of freedom of the press, which is the First Amendment, after all, which shows how important it was to the founding fathers. But if it's going to be observed in the breach, which it was in the run-up to the Iraq War, then the American public and the American Congress are not going to get all the information they need to make the right kinds of decisions on these events that are so influential in our lives.
My guest is former CIA analyst Melvin Goodman. His new book is Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Call us, hang on the line. We'll get to you and bring back my guest right after these messages at WOSU 820 NPR News.
on, you know you want it.
It brings those thoughts of your mama being like, mm-mm.
You know you've got to have it.
Free ice cream!
Free!
Ice cream!
Free!
Really? Not a joke?
Well, don't fight the feeling. Come and get it.
I got the feeling.
Get the latest news and a whole lot more
baby, I got the
on NPR's Day to Day.
Day to Day begins in 30 minutes at noon, right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. It's 53 degrees at 11:31. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. For more than two decades, NPR's Morning Edition has prepared listeners for the day ahead, with up-to-the-minute news, background analysis, commentaries, and coverage of arts and sports. Get your morning update with one of the most respected news magazines in the world, with Steve Inskeep, Renee Montaigne, and WOSU's Marilyn Smith. Every weekday from 5 to 9 a.m. on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and classical music. In the weather forecast for today, cloudy skies today and a high of 58. Clearing skies overnight and a low of 42. For Tuesday, mostly sunny and warmer, a high around 70 degrees for tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, mostly cloudy with showers likely, a chance of an afternoon thunderstorm, and a high of 68. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. My guest, Melvin Goodman, now a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington. He was a senior Soviet analyst at the CIA from 1966 through 86, an intelligence advisor to the SALT delegation in 1971-72. He argues that the Central Intelligence Agency is badly in need of reform following a series of intelligence failures and also the politicization of the agency in the run-up to the war in Iraq. My guest's new book is called Failure of Intelligence. It's subtitled The Decline and Fall of the CIA. We're at 614-292-8513, and you can email a comment or a question to openline at wosu.org. Let's go right to you, callers. Bob is on the line. Hello, Bob.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, there was a great deal of talk about connecting dots and the fact that people didn't connect dots. Graham Allison, in his book about the Cuban Missile Crisis, wrote about he pointed out the importance of thinking of the organizations involved there as being organizations as such with different interests and whatnot. Anyway, it seems to me, I always speculated, that an FBI agent could easily have gone into the boss the day after 9/11 and asked for a raise because he or she had all of the performance boxes checked, and none of those boxes said connect the dots.
Mel, your comments.
Well, you raise an interesting point, because FBI agents are not known to be intelligence analysts. The FBI is not what I consider an analytical organization. They're a law enforcement organization, and they're good in responding to crimes that have already been committed. They've never been very useful in terms of anticipating crimes or breaking up operations or gaining intelligence before these crimes occurred. And one of the reforms that we needed to make that the 9/11 Commission didn't emphasize was the need to create more of an analytical culture at FBI, and we still don't have that. But the CIA, I think, is primarily charged with, as you say, connecting the dots. And Fred used the word lack of imagination. Imagination being the operative word here, which would be part of connecting the dots. And clearly, this wasn't done. And intelligence work is connecting the dots. It's looking at this mosaic and seeing what kind of pattern all of these stones make. And sometimes not all the stones are there. Some of them are missing. So you have to make your own connections. And 9/11, this clearly was not done.
Mm-hmm. May I continue further?
Very quickly, yeah.
My question is then, it seems to me to be a public servant requires some amount of willingness to sacrifice for the public's behalf in the form of whistleblowing. Should people have quit? And these are not the only whistleblowers that could possibly be there. James Hansen has minders, Soviet-style minders, keeping him in line when he speaks.
Now, he can now speak freely. He was on the show last week, and that's at NASA, and he's fine. But the interesting question, should some people...
It is an interesting question. And I was a whistleblower. I resigned in 1990, and I testified against Bob Gates in 1991, and I feel I've been whistleblowing ever since. But again, as I said earlier, the system is not friendly to contrarians. Whistleblower legislation, which does exist, it's on the books, the Congress has passed it, but it doesn't include intelligence officers. So intelligence officials don't have the protection other whistleblower has. And when you think of whistleblowers, basically, think of Colleen Rowley of the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
She's been marginalized by our society. She's been marginalized by the media. She was marginalized by the government. So I think there needs to be more whistleblowers. There needs to be more people who stand up and say, I think I have to resign in this situation. Colin Powell should have resigned. He was opposed to the war. He was the only one in that administration who had been in a war, who understood the danger of warfare and knew that war wasn't called for in this situation. It wasn't the last resort. We hadn't tried all of our policy options. But instead, he decided to play along. George Tenet did the same thing. So I wish from time to time, I mean, you can't have chaos in an organization, but from time to time, a key person needs to stand up and say, Mr. President, I can't support you on this one. It's better that I leave your team, better that I leave your administration. And you need presidents who encourage that kind of contrarian thinking. We now know that we have a very stubborn president who doesn't want contrarian thinking, who doesn't want dissent, who doesn't want differences expressed with regard to policy. And that's why we're in this terrible mess that we're in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Bob, thanks for your call. Mel, has there been a president in the history of the CIA who has encouraged contrarian thinking?
Well, that's an interesting question. Jimmy Carter was a president who did so in the late 70s, and you might say maybe he encouraged too much contrarian thinking because he could never decide between his right and his left. You know, on his right in the 1970s, he had Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the National Security Advisor, who was very anti-Soviet. On his left, he had a Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance, and his Soviet advisor, Marshall Shulman, who were more liberal and wanted to negotiate with the Soviet Union. And Carter's problem was he could never come to terms with these two points of views to decide what his own policy should be. But he is certainly one who encouraged that kind of thinking. And actually, John Kennedy, in his own way, was supportive of contrarian thinking. And Lyndon Johnson at least acknowledged it and didn't try to stifle it the way Richard Nixon did by sending James Schlesinger out to the CIA to tell all of us. He called all of the Soviet analysts together and said, look, you've got to stop screwing Richard Nixon. Screwing is not the word he used. It was a lot more harsh than that.
What did he mean by that? What had you been doing that he wanted you to stop?
He wanted intelligence that supported the president's point of view. So in the case of the Soviet Union, he didn't want us to be so forthcoming with regard to indications that the Soviets wanted to negotiate arms control, that the Soviets wanted to be helpful in Vietnam, but really had no influence whatsoever in Vietnam. Kissinger always believed that the key to getting out of Vietnam was having the support of Moscow. Well, Moscow had no influence in Vietnam, which is something Kissinger never understood. And this is a part of the great power mentality, and we see it today with regard to terrorism. We don't believe that small groups, non-state actors like Al-Qaeda or the Palestinian groups in the 1980s, can commit acts of terrorism without the support of big policy actors like the Soviet Union in the 1980s with vis-a-vis the Palestinians, or Iraq today with regard to Al-Qaeda. And this is where people like Kissinger and Nixon and Bush and Cheney today do not understand the real world and the fact that the tail often wags the dog in this real world and these real world scenarios.
Do you think we're beginning to understand the capabilities of these small groups that are not supported by any state?
No, I really don't, because we're using all of the wrong policies. The notion that somehow military force is going to deal with terrorism or that air power is going to deal with insurgency shows that we don't have a clue. And now I hear these calls for putting more troops into Afghanistan. We're making the same mistake the British made in Afghanistan in the 19th century and the Soviet Union made in Afghanistan in the 20th century. Now we're doing it. We're up to, 45,000 NATO troops in Afghanistan. Bob Gates now wants to pull the Marines out of Iraq and send them to Afghanistan. That is not what we should be doing. So this belief that military power and military force is a counterinsurgency weapon shows that we don't have a clue to how to deal with this very difficult problem, but not a problem that that is without a solution.
What is the solution?
The solution is very painstaking, and it's incremental, and it's dealing with terrorism in terms of good intelligence, good law enforcement, good intelligence and liaison, cooperating with other intelligence services, which the 9/11 Commission failed to understand. Occasionally, modest military force in a very incremental way, but not use of large armies or mechanized equipment, and particularly air power. Every time we use air power, we create more terrorists and we create more insurgents. We may call it collateral damage.
We kill civilians, yeah.
But to the enemy, to the insurgents or to the terrorists, they look at it as terrorism, that we're terrorizing these societies, and so we create more enemies.
But how can the various things you described, you say occasionally small military operations, I can see how this could work against terrorist plotting, et cetera, but how would that stop an insurgency?
Well, it can't stop an insurgency, but can certainly limit an insurgency. Al-Qaeda has been incredibly crippled. The way the administration portrays Al-Qaeda, I think, has nothing to do with reality. When we went into Afghanistan in October of 2001, we were extremely successful. Now, we didn't capture bin Laden, but frankly, I don't think that's our biggest problem today, the fact that bin Laden wasn't captured. The fact of the matter is we drove Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan. They were routed, and our problem now is in Pakistan, and our problem is a diplomatic one in terms of getting the Pakistan government more involved in this counterinsurgency. But we have Al-Qaeda in a situation where they can't control international terrorism the way they did up to the World Trade Center attacks of 9/11. And basically, if you look at the Muslim governments of the Middle East, they are still on our side in all of this. We have good state-to-state relations with Egypt and with Jordan and with Saudi Arabia and the sheikhdoms of the Persian Gulf and certainly the governments of North Africa. We could have decent state-to-state relations with Syria, but this is an administration that doesn't use diplomacy, and certainly it's an administration that's worsened our relations with a Muslim but non-Arab state, which is key in that region, which is Iran. You know, the idea that we could invade Iraq without creating a Shiite government in Baghdad that would have eventually close ties to Tehran shows how misguided all of the so-called strategists were who were planning this war. So we're paying for all of their ignorance about the Middle East and the Persian Gulf, and we're going to be paying for a very long time.
My guest, Melvin Goodman, was a senior Soviet analyst at the CIA from 1966 through 86. His new book is Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. 614-292-8513, open line at WOSU.org for your comments by email and your questions by email. Kevin's on the line. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I just want to switch gears for a second and touch upon China for a moment. With the talk of intelligence being politicized, that you know has kind of been an issue in much of what you've been talking about. I'm wondering, what is the general culture on Chinese intelligence? And I don't mean just recently, but in the past maybe decade or 5 years. And do you see the same sort of politicization there that could be dangerous in trying to create a certain view of China? You know, is intelligence being construed a certain way in that case?
Good question. Mel?
That's an excellent point, Kevin, and you raise what I think is today's major problem. I look at China today the way I looked at the Soviet Union in the 1980s. It was clear that the Soviet Union in the 1980s wanted a good state-to-state relationship with the United States. They didn't want to threaten the United States. They didn't want any kind of dust-up or third-world confrontation with the United States. And today I look at China as a country that has serious economic problems. It has a growing economy. It's now the fourth-largest economy in the world, but it has serious infrastructure problems. And they have a modernization program that emphasizes non-military priorities over military priorities. But if you talk to people in the government, particularly in the Pentagon, China is that great threat. And when I was when I left the CIA, I went to the National War College, and all the war games that were played in the 1990s, China was always the threat. to United States power 20 years down the road. And when you look at military intelligence on China, again, it's a worst-case assessment. And I consider this a terrible self-fulfilling prophecy. If you want China to be a threat and you conduct your relations accordingly, China ultimately will be perceived as threatening to what you're trying to do. So far, however, and I think this is important in terms of your question, I think the CIA is standing up to this conventional wisdom and trying to analyze China in the most fair-minded and objective way possible. But there's pressure being put on the CIA by neoconservatives, by the right wing, by right-wing newspapers such as the Washington Times, accusing the CIA of politicizing the issue of China. But really, the politicization is coming from the right that needs a threat. And that's that insidious notion that we have of ourselves, that we're some kind of superpower and therefore can control all of these activities, and we have to worry about China 10 years down the road. There's no reason why the United States and China have to be major rivals in Asia or anywhere else in the world. Certainly they will be competitors. China is a large, growing economy. They're competing with the United States for energy. That's what's in part driving up the price of oil and leading to the food shortages that we have in terms of distribution and other energy competition. But the idea of a confrontation with China seems totally far-fetched to me. But there is the risk that the conventional wisdom will have an impact on the intelligence, and that this self-fulfilling prophecy will produce China as a threat.
Mm. Kevin, follow-up question?
Yeah, quick follow-up question. In light of what you said, and I kind of sense the same thing, too, that there's sort of this realist mentality in the government still that sees this as a Cold War situation, how is it then that we, and when I say we, I should say people in the CIA as well as people maybe in the State Department that are working in diplomacy, how can people that are involved in this prevent these sort of ad hoc arguments? Is there anything they can do that will prevent this you know, current that's going towards competition and conflict, or I should say conflict rather than competition?
Well, both the CIA and the State Department have institutions that if they were vigorous institutions could help to counter this trend. For example, the State Department has an institution called the Policy Planning Department. But the problem is that the Policy Planning Department does very little policy planning. But here is where you should have senior people writing about policy options and opportunities, because there are incredible opportunities with China that wants to be more of a stakeholder in the international community, wants to play more of a role than China traditionally has ever played in international affairs, but because of their large size and their growing economy, they've been forced to take on this role. But policy planning under, and particularly the State Department under Condoleezza Rice, has really been quite sclerotic in looking for policy opportunities of this type. And it's up to the CIA to keep hitting the government, and particularly the Congress and the Armed Forces Committees and the Foreign Relations Committees, with intelligence that shows what China is really up to. And clearly the total picture is that China is trying to be a responsible international player. But even if you look at the political campaign, and particularly John McCain's campaign, which is designed to force Russia out of the Group of Eight and make sure that China is never brought into these international bodies, there's still this tendency to use Cold War thinking in talking about China. And you just have to wonder, is it because the United States, again, with this superpower mentality, always needs to have some threat out there to justify this huge defense spending that's at record levels that needs to be kept because of the economic problems it's creating and certainly stifling debate in this country?
Kevin, thanks for your questions. You know, trying to bring up the question of how does one approach, and I don't know what the intelligence component of this is, but the policy question is how to approach a leading country which has human rights depredations, the situation in Tibet, for example.
Of course, that's not an intelligence problem. All intelligence can do is really describe the human rights situation and to identify the victims of the human rights situations. And, of course, there's been cases where the CIA has exfiltrated people who were threatened in countries. This has never been told, but the CIA was key to getting certain dissidents out of China in 1989 during the massacre at Tiananmen Square. These were people who were being hunted by the Chinese government, who certainly, if they hadn't been executed, certainly would have been jailed for their human rights activities. So the CIA has played an operational role that I think has been useful to American national security. But policymakers ultimately have to make the call. It is their call to make. Is how do you weigh, say, the lack of freedom of the press and the lack of freedom of assembly that we're seeing in Moscow, for example, under the Putin administration and now under the Medvedev Putin administration, with the need to have good relations with Russia, dealing with nuclear cooperation and third world cooperation and denuclearization of North Korea and Iran. And my fear is we shouldn't let human rights drive all of these questions. Clearly, human rights are important, but so are these very important geopolitical issues between Moscow and the United States or between Beijing and the United States. So these human rights issues shouldn't be violated. But we shouldn't be hypocrites about this either. So if we encourage an election in Gaza and the West Bank, but a group wins the elections, such as Hamas, that we label a terrorist organization and refuse to do business with them, we can't have it both ways. That just introduces the issue of hypocrisy in American foreign policy. So we're going to have to practice what we preach, but we shouldn't preach the message so hard that we deny certain advantages in national security negotiations that would be useful to all of us who are interested in national security and would benefit from a more stable foreign policy than we've seen in the past 7 years.
My guest, Mel Goodman, with us for a few more minutes. He was senior Soviet analyst at the CIA, 1966 through 1986. His new book is Failure of Intelligence, subtitled The Decline and Fall of the CIA. And we have Bob on the line. Hello, Bob.
Hi, Fred. How you doing? You know, you were just talking about human rights violations, and of course the most glaring omission in that little blurb was the rendering that the CIA has been doing and how they can claim any moral superiority towards other countries that they accuse of abusing human rights when we do it so indiscreetly ourselves.
The rendition of suspects to countries who will likely torture them is what you're talking about here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the failure for those people that have been rendered to seek legal recourse and compensation for their trauma. But what I wanted to talk about really was one of the big problems with the CIA is its and the intelligence community is its adamant refusal to declassify information that no longer needs to be maintained due to its nature. It's incredible the level that it's risen to. A prime example is when Rice, as national security advisor, refused to release the title of the presidential brief because it would undermine important intelligence information, and I can't remember the exact title, but it was something to the effect of Osama bin Laden or al-Qaeda intends to attack the United States with airplanes. The title itself didn't disclose anything other than a great amount of embarrassment towards the administration. One of the problems that we've got, we've spent so much incredible amount of money in funding the intelligence communities, and success rate is pretty abysmal.
So,
unfortunately,
question.
I'm sorry?
Question.
Yeah. Why don't we – you can't disband these people because they're dangerous. Why don't we redirect their efforts into monitoring internal domestic law enforcement activities, because there seems to be enough corruption, power abusive behavior, and even the FBI, you were talking about what a great reputation they've got and how quickly we forget the scrutiny that they were under fire for altering and destroying evidence.
So your question is you wanted to redirect CIA personnel to do what?
The intelligence community to investigate and monitor our own domestic law enforcement agencies.
Well, Mel, there's
some
restrictions.
Probably the worst idea I've ever heard. Here, I've written a book that talks about the power of the CIA and the need to control the CIA, and you seem to agree with that message, Bob, but now you want to take the intelligence community and turn it on ourselves. I find that frightening. Now, I agree with you about renditions, and I have a chapter in the book called Crimes of the CIA. These are crimes. These are crimes that need to be reported to the Justice Department, and these people should be punished. Renditions is nothing but kidnapping, and it's harmed the American reputation all over the world. We're turning people over to Middle Eastern intelligence organizations where we know, we have evidence, we have documented evidence, the fact that they have been tortured, and some of the tortured captives have given false intelligence that was used by Colin Powell in his speech to the UN. But the idea of taking these domestic intelligence organizations sounds like something I would expect in a fascist society, that this is Orwellian thinking come true. So no, this is not a proper role for the intelligence community. In fact, the intelligence community by law is prevented from being involved in domestic matters, and that's why the Church Committee, Senator Frank Church in 1975-76, held his hearings to try to limit the power of the CIA, which was abused. When I was a member of the anti-war movement, I was being monitored by the CIA, and of course I also happened to be an employee of the CIA, so that was a rather ironic turn of events too. So no, this is certainly not a proper role for the CIA or any of these intelligence organizations.
Okay, Bob, thanks for your call. We just have a couple of minutes left. But, Mel, the CIA has acknowledged using waterboarding on three al-Qaeda suspects in 2002-2003. And then also the CIA has destroyed videos showing harsh interrogation techniques used against two al-Qaeda suspects. Should the CIA be torturing its suspects?
No. And when I was at the CIA and I talked to people who dealt in the field of interrogation, I never talked to a professional who felt that torture and abuse was an effective way of gathering intelligence. And I know the FBI believes that. And if you, again, look at the success of torture and abuse or the lack of success, it's a lot of the bogus information you collect when you torture someone. So it's illegal. It's immoral. It violates the Constitution with regard to cruel and unusual punishment. And I can't think of anything more embarrassing than the document that we just received to show how the CIA was demonstrating torture techniques, including waterboarding, in the White House before Cheney, before Rumsfeld, yeah, and Ashcroft and Rice and Tenet. And at the end of that conversation, Condi Rice, the National Security Advisor, turns to the CIA Director George Tenet and says, "This is your baby, George. Go do it." Mm. That was a sad moment in American history for me.
We just have less than a minute left. Should the CIA agents who tortured, should they be prosecuted?
Of course they should be prosecuted. In fact, a lot of the memos that were written that Jack Goldsmith, and he's written a wonderful book about the terror presidency, a lot of the memos that were written by Gonzalez and John Yoo and Jay Bybee were designed to exonerate the CIA and make sure they were free from any punishment. And CIA lawyers wanted these documents written before the CIA ordered its people to conduct torture. But these were violations of law, and law should trump all of these invalid orders that were given, that were illegal orders. And Jack Goldsmith knew they were illegal, and that's why he rewrote all of these memos. And that, of course, is why the CIA destroyed the tapes, because it's documentary evidence of illegal activity. If any of those tapes had good evidence on it that we actually learned something from this torture and abuse, believe me, those films would not have been destroyed.
Mel Goodman, former senior Soviet analyst at the CIA, new book, Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Mel, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Fred. It was my pleasure.
Listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News. We'll be right back.